We are much too book-bound mm-hmm. in our worship in the West. When I say West, I mean Western civilization. Let me give you a statistic that's going to knock you flat. When you first meet me, 55% of everything that you perceive about me, you perceive non-verbally. I don't know where they get these statistics, and I'll bet you could even extend that 55%. I bet it might even be more than that. How I stand, how I walk, how I gesture, whether I smile or whether I frown, all of that is nonverbal. Body language, clothing, even dress. Okay, on top of that, say the scholars and the statistic, the number crunchers, 38% is still not the meaning of the words, but it's what they call vocal. In other words, whether I shout at you or whether I whisper. Whether I speak way up here high or whether I speak very low, all of that is vocal. Like the sidewalk preacher in the story that I told yesterday. You know, he's preaching a sermon about love, but he's slamming his fist into his palm, and he's shaking his fist at the people, and wagging his finger at them, and frowning, and shouting, you know, abrasive shouts. That's all. Train a puppy, and you'll have an idea what vocal means. Bad dog. No, the dog doesn't speak English, but the tail goes between the leg, and under the chair he goes, right? Okay, training a little kid, for that matter. All of that is vocal. What's left? 55% nonverbal, 38% vocal. What's left?
Not much, yeah.
7%. 7%, dear friends, is verbal, is the actual meaning of my words. Now that statistic should give a preacher nightmares. Or a teacher or a parent. And as you get to know me, I'm pretty sure that verbal increases and the other decreases a little bit. But in your first exposure to me, I'll bet it's something close to 55% nonverbal, 38% vocal, and only 7% the actual meaning of my words. Moving along. Worship, ritual, liturgy is action. In the next instance, it is enacting what is significant in life. You don't get together to do ridiculous or superficial stuff. I mean, playing Monopoly maybe, or Pinochle is superficial. But ritual, at its best, is acting out what is very significant to you. So, Holy Communion, baptism, and so on. But that's significant stuff. And the people who write the books on ritual study talk about ritual giving shape and meaning to life, and they talk about ritual times, the church year. Ritual spaces, church architecture. Ritual actions, lifting the bread in the cup, pouring water on a baby's head. Ritual objects, ritual qualities, ritual language, thee and thou for a long time. You know, we had thee and, you know, special language for God. I think that's suspect. We'll get to that in the fifth session, the session on Friday. That is to say, I don't think Jesus used a special language for God. In fact, he said we should call God what?
Daddy.
Abba, Daddy. Yeah. Ritual beliefs, ritual groups, ritual figures, ritual types. Rituals of passage from one condition to another. Rituals of status conferral. Can you think of a church ritual that's a ritual of status conferral?
Ordination.
Ordination, maybe? Yeah, sure. Rituals of rituals of status maintenance. Rituals of status reversal. Rituals of celebration. Rituals of mobility. Rituals of purification. All of these, you know, it goes on and on and on. I mean, there are different kinds of rituals for different cultures, and the Hottentots over in Africa or wherever they live, you know, they have specific rituals like this. The Native Americans have those kinds of rituals. Christians have those kind of rituals. Jean, were you raising your hand, or Emma?
That is something they have talked about, and I've read books about in American culture, is that we have lost so many rituals. We have so few rituals in our culture.
And the rituals we have are pretty impoverished.
Right.
Yeah. you want a test of that, watch Survivor. Have you followed that through the summer on television? Survivor, this hokey reality television is an oxymoron, somebody says. If it's television, it ain't real. Okay, moving along. Christian worship is corporate. It's not just private. It's not just me and Jesus, or me and God, or you and God. It's all of us. And there's some significant things. I'm going to talk about this tomorrow. How can we show? How can we demonstrate? How can we act out that we are together in this? Pastor and people, leaders and people. Kierkegaard has this wonderful little speech in Purity of Heart is to Will One Thing. And have you read Kierkegaard in that little essay? He makes the point that even our church architecture contributes to a misapprehension that when you come into worship, you're an audience sitting in an auditorium watching or listening to somebody laying a speech on you or entertaining you maybe. And then that's terrible. We got to get away from that.
But that's the exact trend of Protestantism in the U.S.
Say that again?
That's the major trend of Protestantism.
It is. It's terrible, right? It's a dead end liturgically and in terms of the gospel. You find churches that are dedicated to this kind of entertainment evangelism. And boy, it's bad news in my view. I'll speak more about that as the week goes on. But in Christian worship, at its most ideal, we are all together worshiping God. And I, as the leader, as the worship leader, am simply the prompter, trying to prompt your praise. It's your voice that's most important. I'm not putting on a show for you. At Vespers, you know, the leaders there at Holden Village, they're not putting on a show or even there to inspire you. They're there to lead you and to prompt you. They're like cheerleaders on the field and you're the team. So that's a misapprehension that even our architecture can feed and can promote. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, it's a corporate ritual. It involves the whole person. Body, mind, intellect, imagination, emotion. Every aspect of the human being. Five senses. Seeing, touching, tasting, feeling, what am I missing? Hearing,
smelling.
I mean, even incense, you know, they used that at Vespers, didn't they, the other night? Wonderful. No reason why that should be excluded. It addresses the whole person, all your faculties and all your senses and all the qualities of your being, including your imagination, let's hope. Not just the top of the head event. Left brain and right brain, intellectual, relational, kinetic. At communion, you got to get up from your chair and go forward and get the bread and wine and chew it and swallow it and digest it. God wants to meet you at the level of the molecules. I mean, that's one of the points of communion. God is not content just with addressing the top of your head. God wants to get in you, inside you, change you. Meet you at the level of the atoms and the molecules. Moving along, five, it's multivocal. Again, I think there's this pathology or sectarianism, if I may call it, among Lutherans particularly, that says all the meaning, all the sense, all the importance in worship is the words, the verbalizing. And in contrast to that, or in contradiction to that, number five on my list here, many voices speaking, sure, the verbal, but also the nonverbal, the kinetic, all of that stuff. It meets you at every level. All of the arts address you. The language and the meaning in worship comes through as elusive. This is again from the ritual studies people, and you can find it in the South Sea Islands, and you can find it in American Indian culture, and you can find it in High Mass among the Roman Catholics. It's elusive, it's symbolic, it's elliptical, comes at you from left field sometimes. It's formalized, it's repetitive. Why should we be surprised that we say, Lord have mercy, Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy, Christ have mercy, Lord. You know, Calvinists and Protestants think, well, three times is plenty, but Greek Orthodox want to do it 9 times or 20 times.
40.
Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy. A voice? A comment?
40. It says 40.
Orthodox do it 40 times.
How many?
40.
40, wonderful. Any of you been to an Orthodox service? I mean, that can last for 3 hours. People going and coming, I mean, it's wonderful. Formalized, stylized, patterned, condensed. And right here is where you find the fundamentalist problem. A fundamentalist, it seems to me, is a person who cannot handle metaphor, cannot handle allusions or figures of speech. And yet, that's what worship is all about. Figures of speech. The kingdom of God is like a householder who went out, etc. The kingdom of God is like a woman who lost her coin. You know, Jesus is full of that. And so is our worship full of that. And if you can't handle metaphor or allusions or figures of speech, you're in big trouble. It's poetic. Moving along. 6, it's where faith engages all of the arts. Worship is a corporate art form. And this is what turned me on when, oh dear, 40 years ago, 45 years ago, but it was 5 years after I was ordained. I've been ordained almost 50 years now. I'm 70 years old. I was ordained in 1956. And for the first 5 years, and I'm a pastor's son, furthermore. I mean, I heard my dad preaching all this stuff, or preaching stuff like it anyhow, Sunday after Sunday, but it never came home to me. I was the kind of a kid, you know, who would rather draw and paint than come to supper. And my mother used to go be tearing her hair. Paul, get in here. I always loved all of the arts, drawing, painting, theater, play acting, music, singing, the choir. I was in the choir and in the drama club and taking art, even in college at the university level. I still take art. I still paint. I love it. And it only occurred to me 5 years after I was ordained, that the place where Christian faith engages all of the arts is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning at worship, because you're dealing with these prayers and these hymns, if not these, others, right? You're dealing with this kind of architectural arrangement, and if not this, some other. You cannot not do without the arts. Have I said that right? You cannot avoid the arts when you're dealing with worship. You're deciding where to stand, the gestures to use. You're deciding whether you're going to wear vestments or not, and the message that those vestments preach, the candles, the ceremony, whatever that might be, the words of your prayers, the words of your liturgies, the music, the melodies, that wonderful melody we sang a few minutes ago from Gustav Holst. I mean, all that stuff communicates. Believe me, it does. And a lot of times it communicates at a subconscious or unconscious level, but people get it anyhow. And people are starved for what the theologians these days call primary experience. Why do we get all weepy-eyed at Christmas Eve with the candlelight and the smell of the evergreen? Because the candlelight takes us back to an era that our fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers could take for granted, when that's the only illumination they had. And there's something very basic and primary about that. Baptism, as you may know, primitive baptism was naked baptism. Adults too. You took off your clothes as a sign that you were rejecting the old life. And you went into the water completely dunked in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit. You came out on the other side and they put a white robe on you. That's where the alb comes from in our worship. The white robe is the garment of baptism. Now that's primary experience. What a wonderful picture that is. You're clothed in the righteousness of Christ, having rejected the old life that your old clothes represent. You go naked into the water, you come out of the water, and you put on the white robe of Christ. I think that's terrific. Moving along. Because it engages all the arts, liturgy and worship also has a history, like all art forms. And we're going to get into the history of architecture in just a minute. Furthermore, number seven, it is familial. That's not familiar, although they're related terms. Familial, like the family. It's popular, it's amateur, it's non-elite, and it's what you might call koine. Do you know that word, you Greek scholars? Koine is the language of the New Testament. The New Testament was not written in classical Greek, like Cicero and, he's Latin, isn't he? Homer and those guys. Anyhow, it's not written in classical Greek. It's written in what they call Koine Greek, which is the Greek of the marketplace. Common Greek. Just folks Greek. And liturgy, worship at its best, is not for the elite and for the upper class. It's for everybody. So it's common. It's amateur. Do you know the root of the word amateur? From the Latin amo amas amat? Love. An amateur is somebody who loves what they do. Isn't that nice? Don't have to be expert at it, but you just have to love it. Okay, finally, it is also contextual, that is to say, situational, context-specific, this time, this place. You have to be initiated into the rite. You come to my church and there are some things we're going to be doing that are strange to you, and you're going to have to learn how to cope with that. And if I'm a good host, I'll help you or try to help you learn my family's rituals. If I go to your church, I expect the same thing. You come to my house for supper, you're going to get a linen napkin and a napkin ring. And maybe you never used one before. Well, it would behoove you as guests to look around the table and see how other people are using theirs. And it would behoove me as host to make that an easy task for you. Okay. You must not be surprised, therefore, number eight, at having to work at it. Ha! Have to work.
She's going back to work.
At learning. You're going to say?
I said that's what she's doing, going back to work.
Oh, dear, dear. Maybe she's offended at what I'm saying.
No.
Okay, let us turn now to architecture more specifically, and I want to give, take a break. Talk to your neighbor right now. I'll give you a minute and a half. Talk to your neighbor, see if any of this makes sense to you. More specifically, the history of architectural technology. Let's go back to the Stone Age. I just spent 2 weeks in Ireland and saw these magnificent dolmens. Oh, passage tombs. Oh, Newgrange. Any of you been to these places? Marvelous.
How about Stone Age?
Get this. Here are four or five standing stones, each of them weighing a couple of tons. These are Stone Age people who don't have the wheel. They haven't invented the wheel yet. You tell me how they move them. Here are these upright stones, orthostats, isn't that a nice word? And on top of it, what they call a capstone that can weigh 10 tons. There's one capstone on a dolmen that weighs 100 tons. And they're slave labor, I'm sure. They're pulling them, rolling them on logs, and they're building an earth ramp to put them in place, and then when they're in place, they dig away the earth. I mean, can you imagine the labor? Okay, Stone Age people, what did they live in? I mean, even before Stone Age.
Caves.
A cave, a hole in the ground. I mean, you had to get shelter from the elements, so you lived in a cave. What's the next step in technology?
Teepee,
tent. You put up sticks and you wrap bark or hides of animals around it, and you have a shelter. And it's very portable, you know. You take the thing down and put it on a travois behind a horse and drag it to the next place and put it up. And it's like camping out here, too. You take a tent into the wilderness, except you got fiberglass poles and ripstop nylon, right? So the tent is the next step. Next step, what they call post and lintel. These are the posts, these upright pieces, and that's the lintel. Buildings today still built that way. What do they call them?
Post and beam.
What's that?
Post and beam.
Post and beam? Post and lintel, yeah. I'm thinking of in the agricultural world.
Barns.
Barns, yeah. Most barns are to this day still post and lintel or post and beam, and you know, sometimes there'll be braces as well. But they're still building buildings like that. Have we an architect in our midst? Wonderful. Okay, you check me, see if I'm telling the right story here. If I'm wrong, he can correct us, either during or after. Okay, the next step, and it's a significant step, is the arch. They're piling stone upon stone, and at the top of the arch, they're putting in what they call a keystone that's shaped like a wedge. And that wedge has the effect of putting the stress out and down. Am I pretty nearly accurate? If they took away that keystone, the whole arch would fall apart. And again, at first it's pretty simple, but then it gets very complex and very beautiful. Classical Greek architecture is based on both post and lintel, post and beam, and the arch. So you have these wonderful classical arches, Romanesque architecture, classical architecture. If you put stones alongside the wall to brace them every now and then, those would be called buttresses. And Gothic architecture, I'm going to skip here for a minute, Gothic architecture makes these buttresses freestanding. They're called flying buttresses, so that you can have thinner walls, more glass, and the whole structure, if you look at it from an airplane, you ever been to see Notre Dame in Paris in an airplane? Looks like a spider web made out of stone. Wonderful. Altogether incredible technology. In between the dome, I think Hagia Sophia, Holy Wisdom in Istanbul. I've never been there. I've been to most of these other places I'm talking about. But Hagia Sophia, I think that dome was built by, again, building a huge earth, filling the whole thing in with earth, so to speak, and putting the dome up on the outside of the earth and then excavating the earth. But the dome, for instance, in St. Peter's in Rome and the dome at St. Paul's in London, and most domes that you see are really three domes. The outside dome that you see from the outside, a support dome or structure inside, and then inside that, the dome that you see if you're standing on the floor looking up inside. And I climbed up here, they got stairways, and I climbed up here in St. Paul's in London, and in fact, I even stuck my head up here in the little ball under there. They have a little cupola up there, you can look out over the whole city. Used to be able to do that, maybe you can't do it anymore. But that kind of a dome, anyhow, is, again, it's based on the arch, but you got three arches here, including the structural one that holds the whole thing up, that you don't see. I talked about Gothic and its arches and its flying buttresses. And then the next major step, pre-stressed concrete and the steel skeleton of skyscrapers. Well, Louis Sullivan and Frank Lloyd Wright and those guys way back at the turn of the century, they discovered, I took a wonderful walking tour of Chicago one time by an architect student. And he showed us on opposite corners of an intersection, here's a building that's built using the old stone upon stone architectural technique. You can build perhaps 12 stories high that way. But if you get higher than 12 stories, the walls at the bottom have to be too thick to support it all. Then along comes steel, and you build a skeleton, and dear friends, you're back here at the tent again, really, because the walls are just curtains. And here is the 12-story stone-upon-stone building in downtown Chicago, and here is a 13-story skyscraper, Louis Sullivan, with the metal, steel structure, and the walls are just curtains. They're just skin of maybe stone or aluminum or glass or whatever, but they can be of any material because the whole thing is held up by this tent of steel. And I heard an architect one day say that it was Michelangelo really who built the first modern building because the dome of St. Peter's in Rome is held together by a big cable at the bottom. And it's the principle of the tent. And you've got modern skyscrapers now. This is the Chrysler Building in New York City. This is the Citicorp Tower in New York City. And this is one of the World Trade Center towers. Woo-hoo. And the reason we can go up so high, Frank Lloyd Wright has the plans for a mile-high building. People don't think it was ever built, but he thinks it could be done. And today, of course, you've got those wonderful shells in the Sydney Opera House in Australia. And you've got the Bilbao Spain Museum by Frank Gehry with those undulating brick walls, and titanium. I mean, you got real freaky stuff happening today because of concrete and steel. Okay, that's a brief overview of the technology of architecture as I know it. Let us take a look now at how that all applies to the church. You got to have a place out of the rain where you can worship. So, number one on my little diagram here is Dura Europas. It's the oldest existing house church, and it's in Turkey, present-day Turkey. And it's a simple three-room space. The first room with a little door in it is a kind of a narthex. It's actually a house that's been modified, a private home that has been modified for the use of Christian worship. There's a little kind of a narthex. Just off the narthex is a baptistry, believe it or not, with a kind of a hot tub. I've seen pictures of it. I have not been to Dura Europas. I've been to these other places that I'm going to talk about. Anyhow, the baptistry is a separate room, and when they baptized, they took you into a separate room. On the walls are frescoes of Christ feeding the 5,000 and so on. The communion room is altogether empty except for a table in the middle, and the family gathers around it with the bishop presiding, just like the papa or the mama at the head of the table at Thanksgiving in your home. Okay, that's the very first and the most primitive form of Christian worship, and it's simply a modified private dwelling. When Constantine comes along, he makes the Christian church, as I said yesterday, not simply legal and tolerable, but the religion of the empire. So they begin to build the first distinctly Christian church buildings. And you can find some of them in Rome and other places in Italy. The place that I've tried to sketch here is called St. Apollinare in Classe, which is in Ravenna, Italy, on the east coast of Italy, the Adriatic Sea, just south of Venice. And it's a magnificent building filled with mosaics. Oh, gorgeous mosaics. There's another St. Apollinare in the city of Ravenna, but this is just outside the city, a little port town called Classe, C-L-A-S-S-E, and it's a Christian basilica. And what's the model that they use? The Byzantine, or late Roman, early Byzantine imperial law court. The benches against the apse wall here, this is called an apse, are for the judges in the law court. You had an altar in the middle for the offering of offerings to whatever god you wanted to appease. And because it's a law court, you had a lectern on each side, or a pulpit on each side, for prosecuting and defense attorney. And the plaintiffs and the accused and the audience stood here, no seats. Six or seven steps below the level of the apse. Now, that was the Byzantine imperial law court. That's where the emperor held his court and made his decisions when plaintiffs came with conflicting cases at law. And you had the defense attorney and prosecuting attorney, one side or the other, I forget which one. And that's why we got churches today that look like this. You have a nave, you got a chancel. You have an altar, you have a pulpit, you have a lectern, or a pulpit and a lectern, and you got seats for the presiders. Now I ask, is that a good model for what we want to say in Christian worship? Do we want to think of the pastor as judge? Do we want to think of the people as plaintiffs or as accused? Or audience? You know, it's like a theater too, isn't it? Which is also my gripe with the Gothic. When you come into Gothic and Romanesque, looking down on it, you're looking at a cross, and there's nothing wrong with that. Michelangelo originally intended for St. Peter's in Rome to be a Greek cross. He ended it, Greek cross is all four arms equal. And he put the altar here in the middle, and there are little chapels and so on and so on. You've been to St. Peter's, some of you, raise your hand. Yeah. Anyhow, Romanesque and Gothic, and then a lot of churches since then, including the neo-Gothic buildings that have sprung up all over the landscape since the turn of the century. Turn of the century, that is 19th century to the 20th century, you found a movement in the churches called the Oxford Movement. And the Oxford Movement regarded the High Middle Ages as the Age of Faith. So you had essays like Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres by, who is it, Henry Adams? I get those guys mixed up. Anyhow, he's maintaining that this is the Age of Faith, expressing faith. I think you should ask Martin Luther whether he thought the Middle Ages were the Age of Faith or not. And you've got a very clearly defined chancel. You have what they call an east wall altar. I should say, even since the earliest days, a lot of churches were built, most churches maybe, with the altar end in the east, so that you face the rising sun, you face Jerusalem, the holy city, the place where the Messiah was going to return. Nice image, you know, nice symbolism. If that's the east, then this is what?
West.
This is west. Gotta get a better pen. This is west. How about the other compass directions? So to this day, if I'm not mistaken, and the architect among us can correct me if I'm wrong, wherever the altar is, that's the east end for a lot of architects. I mean, it's just a convention. An east wall altar, in any case, divided choir, the choir seats are facing each other, but once you get beyond the chancel, all the seats, or in the case of the original, standees, no seats at all originally, people just stood, and they're facing the east. And Ratzinger, Cardinal Ratzinger, who is the present, what is he, congregation for the, he's in Rome, one of the Curia, he's the present Pope's top theologian. And he has written an introduction to a book, the title of which is Facing Toward the Lord. And he's arguing that we should go back to east wall altars, and the priest should turn the back on the people at Mass. Now, since Vatican II, maybe some of you don't remember how great a change that was before you were born, some of you. Well, maybe not. But in any case, in Vatican II, they pulled the altar off from the wall. And in some of the medieval churches these days, over in Europe, you'll see this. As I did, for instance, in St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh, Scotland, which is now Church of England, they've torn out all the, for the most part, Victorian or slightly earlier additions to the inside. And in St. Giles Cathedral, they put the altar right in the middle with a wonderful Celtic knot design in the pavement of the floor underneath the altar. Then they have seats, not pews, but seats facing this way. And even in the chancel, the old chancel, seats facing this way here, and seats facing this way here. So in effect, you've taken an axial building and turned it into a radial building. You dig? Mm-hmm. Now, you can make a case, I think, for almost any architectural arrangement in the sermon that it preaches. Rudolf Schwarz is one of the great architects of our time. He has written a book called The Church Incarnate that you may want to look up. He has 7 basic architectural plans for churches. And if you boil them all down, as I would be inclined to, I would say radial and axial. Those are the 2 choices. Everything else is a kind of combination or permutation of radial and axial. Axial has a very strong sense of direction and movement. It's as if you're like a mighty army, moves the Church of God with the cross of Jesus going on before. The leaders are up in the front, the general, the majors, the colonels, the lieutenants, they're all up in front leading the parade, and the army of God is following, and we're all marching to Jerusalem. Now, that's a pretty good sermon. I ask, however, is that the sermon people ought to hear today? And I would argue that the people today ought to hear about God's imminence. This speaks of God's transcendence. God is out there ahead of us somewhere, maybe far ahead of us. This sense of axial that I was talking about a minute ago. You have the army of God here and the leaders here and God way out there somewhere. That speaks about the transcendence of God. God is different. God is other. God is beyond us. And as I say, that's a pretty decent sermon. However, Martin Luther was very fond of reminding you that God is also among us. Sure, God is beyond us, but God is also among us. And so you have this St. Giles Cathedral arrangement, God in our midst, God in the neighbor. Here you can actually see your neighbor's face. Isn't it nice? This is basically Holden Village, Village Center. You've got altar, pulpit, font, chairs for the presiders, and the people facing each other across an axis, across a central aisle, and you can actually see other people's faces. Wonderful Saarinen building in, what's the name of that town in Indiana? Columbus, Indiana. Have you ever been to Columbus, Indiana? Oh, marvelous. The whole town, I should say, is an architectural wonder. They had some very public-spirited town leaders. Among them, J. Irwin Miller, do you know that name? He was president of the World Council of the National Council of Churches at one time, a committed Christian layperson. But he got the other people and industries in the town to contribute money, and the library, the post office, the schools, the fire hall, they're all designed by top-flight world architects. If you have a congregation and you don't have the money to hire a great architect to build your church, they'll help you financially. I mean, it's a marvelous town. You should go to Columbus, Indiana. You never heard of it before, but it's got some wonderful buildings. Even the fire hall is, I think, I.M. Pei. Wonderful stuff. Anyhow, there are four great architectural signs. We got to quit in a minute, but we want to have a conversation. The font, the ambo. Ambo is a fancy word for when you have just one place of the word. No need to have two places, prosecuting attorney and defense attorney. You have one place to read the word and the same places where you preach the word. Makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. That's preferred, I would say, preferred to both pulpit and lectern. Just one ambo. Ambo is from the Greek, means a raised space. And they have a kind of ambo here. I weep, I've already talked to the authorities about this. Holden Village owns a marvelous treasure that they've stored away in a closet somewhere. That is a pulpit and an ambo by no less than Arnold Flotten, who's one of the world's great sculptors. He took railroad ties from Railroad Creek, wonderful. Chiseled in the body of Christ, the blood of Christ. You've seen one sample of it in there, but they don't use it on a Sunday morning. Pity. The ambo is marvelous too. Font, ambo, altar, or table, I would use either word interchangeably, that's what it is. What do you need for Holy Communion? Nothing but a table, really. Could even preach from the table. That probably wouldn't satisfy churches that think of themselves as churches of the word, however, so I'd vote for an ambo. You need a font somewhere, could be in a separate room, but I like it on the axis the way it is here at Holden. And sedilia, you haven't heard that word before, maybe, but that means the seats, the chairs of the presider. The presiders and the worship leaders are not doing their people any favor when they try to disappear among them, sitting, you know, with everybody else. If you're a leader, one of the burdens of your leadership is to be visible. So, you can be on the same level as they, but I think you should be visible. So the sedilia, the seats of the leaders, you know, in Holden could be here. Let's talk.
Just one, that prosecuting attorney and that defense attorney, that kind of resonates with the local constitution of the congregation in the sense that if you put on that back row, you put the church council, and you basically the congregation is listening to the pastor identifying the meaning of the gospel, and somebody from the other side asking for interpretation, clarification, and then the council make the decisions as to what the church should do. I mean, then it's a...
Then it could make some sense, huh?
Yeah.
Maybe so. And, of course, it's Presbyterian, isn't it? To put the elders behind the altar with the leader, the elders or deacons or whatever you call them, church council. That's neat. And the Pope at St. Peter's in Rome, ever since the beginning, has had the privilege of presiding on the opposite side of a table facing the people facing the Pope. I mean, that's nice. You see my face, I see your face. I much prefer that to having my back to the people. And I kind of like the idea of being on the people's level, too. What are we saying? What message are we sending when we put the pulpit, lectern, altar, whatever, up six steps? You know, here's me and God, folks. All the rest of you down here are peasants. I got problems with chancels. They talk these days about two-room space as over against a one-room space. This is a one-room space. This is a one-room space. This is definitely two rooms. This was two rooms, chancel and nave, but now in its reconfiguration, this, I'm talking about St. Giles Cathedral in Edinburgh, now it's a one-room space.
That's also, you can see that exact thing in St. James Cathedral in Seattle.
Say it again?
St. James Cathedral in Seattle, remodeled.
They remodeled it like that?
Exactly like
that. Wonderful. And apparently there's a church in St. Louis, too, a big cathedral-type church that's remodeled this way.
It's
wonderful.
It's very awkward.
Awkward?
Yes.
Really? Spell that out.
The altar is in the middle, but the lectern is in the corner, one of the corners. In St. James, it's the southwest corner.
It's over here somewhere?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And it's very awkward for some people.
Ah.
St. James also has three or four organs, one in each end.
Oh, boy.
But it's awkward for the presenter.
Huh.
Always has their back to somebody.
Yes, you're like leading a campfire. Again, I hope I made clear last time we met. Whatever choices you make in liturgy and in life, you're always paying a price. I mean, there's no free lunch. Whatever decisions you make, there's some good in it and there's some bad in it. So this, you're saying, has some problems.
Yes. I think there's another form, and that's called the temple form, that the Jews use, and also the Orthodox, except we don't enclose the Holy of Holies. It's open behind an icon screen. But it's also a form.
Is it eastward facing? Or
always.
It...
Always.
And you're looking at the back of somebody's head?
No, you stand. You move.
Can you draw it? I don't understand what you're saying.
Somebody read it?
Yeah. Well, feel free to erase my stuff.
That's all right. I mean, the original temple that Solomon built.
That's a terrible. If you turn it 90 degrees, your pen.
There we are. Solomon built the Holy of Holies here.
Courtyards within courtyards,
and
yeah.
The general people only were out here. The priest came here once a year. The high priest went into the Holy of Holies. Well, they were around here. Today, the temple form in the Orthodox Church, they put a screen across here, but it's still the holy. The altar's there. The people are here, all people. The outside is void. Although in some parts, if you're not baptized or chrismated as an Orthodox, you would be here during communion, because you can't partake of communion unless you're Orthodox.
But that's not practiced anymore.
Right, it's not practiced. So you have the people moving around, but you still have the Holy of Holies. So it's another form.
Yeah, and you still have a two-room space, do you not? In other words, this space, the chancel where the priests go, is separated from the place of the lady.
May be or may not. This may be in an icon screen, very narrow. In our church, it's very narrow. You see right through it.
Yeah.
Some churches, it's only this high.
Yeah, I was going to say, I heard Alexander Schmemann, who is an Orthodox Greek theologian, Russian, Greek, whatever, I mean, from this tradition, and he says the original icon screen was just a low balustrade.
That is correct.
Yeah.
So it's opening up more and more.
But if you go in a lot of Orthodox churches, boy, it's a heavy wall with three little doors in it.
It fills the whole front and it's covered.
Does a lay person ever go back there? No, that's the question.
May not. Men may, not women.
They may, but do they ever? I mean, is there any
yes.
place for them to go back there?
Yes, if they help serve with the priest.
You've been in Gothic churches, and I have too. You've been in Lutheran churches where there's a big rope at the chancel. Do not enter. You know, what signal is that sending?
Put something over your head when you do.
Yeah. And you know, I've got problems with any two-room space.
The other thing in that is to do with the importance of Hagia Sophia, which was built in the 5th century, built this dome, collapsed once, they rebuilt it, still standing today. The Muslims took it over, and now it's back to a museum.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a mixture of the Christian mosaics and the Turkish.
Where did they put the altar in that church, do you know?
It was
in the Eastern
apse.
But it's basically Greek cross cruciform.
Right.
With a dome over each.
Yes.
You know, semi-dome. Dome, and then the big dome here.
Yeah. And it's immense.
I haven't been there. You have, apparently.
Yes. The scale is something unbelievable, even for today. You can't imagine the scale and the number. I assume you could probably get 10,000 people in there without a problem.
Oh, Lord have mercy. Now, that's a question, too. Is that becoming for a Christian church? I mean, that's kind of triumphalist, isn't it? Let's build the biggest building. Let's build, you know, I think this was part of the Middle Ages, too. The Gothic bishop saying, I'm going to build a bigger cathedral than that bishop for the next diocese. That sounds triumphalist to me. Go ahead.
But actually, that's an area of question that I was hoping you might say a little bit more about, because I was in San Francisco at the time that they were going to build the cathedral, Catholic cathedral in San Francisco.
A little louder so these people can hear.
Part of, in San Francisco, when the Catholic Church was going to build a very grand cathedral, and being a student at Berkeley at the time, I was, of course, protesting along with others the grandiosity of this cathedral. And
this money should be spent on the poor.
That's right. And
remember, it's Judas who says that. But no, I'm with you. Triumphalism. There's no place for triumphalism. I made speeches and written books about an optimum size for a Christian building and an optimum size for a Christian congregation. One flock, one shepherd, no multiple services. That's another day's lecture, however. Finish your speech, I interrupted you.
Well, I just think that the whole issue when it comes to art, that as you are wanting to make a beautiful space or drawing or garments, art, like technology, has its own impetus.
Sure does.
To spend lots and lots of money in the process of making something worthy of this highest human endeavor. And so you go back, you know, into these the churches, say in Central America and Mexico, that are gilded in gold, at the same time you know
the people are living in poverty. Yeah.
That was built upon, and yet I have been in some of those churches where people come from these poor villages, and that church
speaks
to their soul.
Yeah, yeah.
And the same in certainly in the medieval Europe, as these cathedrals were being built, and you already mentioned the peasants, this place that was the common, you know, where you gathered for this highest endeavor, whether you were very poor or wealthy. So I just feel extremely ambivalent.
I sure do too.
The effort of the church to create beauty and its cost over against the commitment to serve the poor. And I think those decisions come up all the time.
Absolutely.
Whether it's personal in your own house, or whether it's the community. And I just would love to, if you've got, as you think about this, you know, how do you balance.
I would say it's a very tough call, and I would want to have a beautiful space, but I don't think it has to be bigger than the neighbor's, the cathedral and the neighbor's diocese. I think it maybe should be smaller. Particularly, you know, we're moving into a new era here in Christian experience, and maybe the tabernacle, which is essentially a tent, should supersede the temple as an image, as a metaphor. Temple is grand and permanent and, you know, extravagant. The tabernacle is flexible and temporary. And I think that is a better image these days than the temple.
Along that idea of temporary, I just wanted to comment on number four, where you have a font as a fairly focal point. I just want to comment that when I was a boy growing up in Lutheran churches, one of the bad things I think that I experienced and didn't even think about it at the time was not only that the Lord's Supper was only offered once a month, but it was
four times a year when I was a kid.
But it was also a case of the font being very portable and not central at all. Baptism was something that you hauled out this font and you put it there and you baptized the kid.
And then you put it back in the corner.
And I really think that now we're having much more emphasis upon baptism and the Lord's Supper or Eucharist being a focal point in our worship.
Darn right. You know Richard Kemmerer, any of you know this crazy man over in Leavenworth?
Wonderful.
Look at the
he says, you go into a typical Protestant church and he says, first of all, you have to search for the font. You can't find it. It's off in a corner somewhere, hidden. When you find it, it's got a great big wooden witch's hat cover that gives two men a hernia to remove. And when you remove the cover, what do you find? He says, an aluminum ashtray with a dead fly. He says, how can that possibly suggest the riches of baptism? So you're right, we're living in the age of baptism. And baptismal spaces are coming back to churches that are already built. They're redesigning churches with wonderful, huge fonts. My daughter's church in Manhattan has an enormous font. And you know, you could, as I did, I dunked my baby, my grandchild, bare naked, three times in those waters, and she hollered. But it's central. In that church, it's in the narthex, a huge narthex. I heard an architect say, every church ought to have a narthex as big as a nave. Simply to gather. Have your little tea. At this church, they feed the poor every Sunday with a opulent feast after the service every Sunday. It's laid out on the tables in the narthex. Somebody else had a hand.
I was just going to say, also, we're using a lot more of the running waters.
Running water, yeah. Oh, have you been to Camrose? No, you're not Canadians, are you? Wonderful running water font there. Some of the buildings of Ed Sovic in Minnesota. Great big fonts with running water. Wonderful.
Down in California, with rising land costs, which is just skyrocketing, it's unbelievable what the land costs are down there. Since this gal went to school in Berkeley, land costs have just gone through the roof. We're seeing more and more of the modern architecture, modern church in the year 2000, moving into these tilt-up warehouses and growing churches. You talked about an axial approach, man. It's in a two-story, hollowed-out warehouse building in an industrial area, and these churches are just growing by leaps and bounds. It's scary if you're thinking of the traditional church worship. And you talk about a portable baptistry. Hey, that's the thing. That's the way it goes. We shoved to one side, and they put out folding chairs by the hundreds of people worship, and they put the folding chairs away, and the kids on Saturday night go in there and play basketball, and all. That's the modern church in California.
I served a church for two interims, 4 years altogether, a big downtown church in Kitchener, Ontario, that had a TV ministry. And I was the Robert Schuller of Southern Ontario. not hardly. But anyhow, that church was built in the 60s, and in the days when they thought that a PA system would solve all problems. Well, a PA system is just dreadful. No church should be so big that it needs a PA system. I've heard an architect say this. If the church needs a PA system, it's too big. And you see little tiny country churches that seat 50 and they gotta have a PA system. Terrible. This PA system was a high-priced one in this church in Kitchener. And this radio was falling off my belt, and the thing was squealing in the middle of the sermon. And, oh, you should never have that. High technology does not belong in worship. You're talking to somebody who wears two hearing aids and an artificial heart valve. Anyhow, we got to quit. Something, one last word. I hope this has been stimulating and interesting.
Well, for me, it's very stimulating. I grew up Catholic, you know, with all of the trappings and things. And for the past 10 years, I've been sitting with the Quakers.
Ooh.
And so that's...
They got something to teach us.
Well, you know, and they sit... There is no... I sit in an unprogrammed meeting, and there is no minister. We all sit facing one another and
actually looking in each other's faces.
In each other's faces, and any can be moved to speak. And it is, there is no direction. I mean, all directions are fine as far as that. But that's been a very different way, and to me a very...
they got something to teach us.
Something to move toward, but the simplicity.
It's what?
The simplicity of the room is, as the Shakers, the Quakers, the Amish, all of those, that there is lack of ornamentation to not distract one from what you are truly there for. And so that's nice. I know that different meetings have different thoughts, and there are program meetings.
We got to quit, friend. One more?
Yes,
I also, the Greek Orthodox Church is also very spirit-centered, as is the Quaker meeting.
Uh-huh.
But it has a very formal arrangement with...
And it's full of icons. And
the icon screen is full of icons because icons are windows to heaven. And the apse is the altar. And the altar table is in the apse. And that represents the heavenly kingdom, which we are experiencing through the icons. And so, and all the people are there. And under the dome. And there are chandeliers, which represents the stars. And the whole liturgy is a movement to meet Christ through the Eucharist, but through the music and the prayers, we are lifted into those heavenly spaces, and we enter into the liturgy so that as it progresses, there are no breaks in it, and so it's just a continuous movement until the sacrament is...
And there's something you have
so
to learn.
It's very ornate.
But just the opposite thing, of this. Yes, but they each have their place.
But what I'm saying is it's very ornate, and your meetings are very plain physically, but the focus is they're still on the same kind of spiritual experience. And so they're very similar in that way.
We're going to talk on Friday about apophatic and cataphatic.